chapter in the Bible, it's always good Christian policy to take the darkness and to use it as a foil to offset the grace which is bound to be there. In much the same way as a good jeweler who has a fine pearl to show will take the pearl and set it against a background of black velvet, so that when passers-by look into his shop window, they will be attracted not by the black velvet, but by the pearl that glows in front of the velvet. And so it is in Scripture. The dark chapters of the Bible, which deal with God's judgment and God's wrath and God's displeasure, are chapters not as things in themselves, but they are there to offset the work of God's grace. And that is how it is in the book of Hosea. It's a dark book, as you know, and it's shot through with all the coming disasters on the northern kingdom. And Hosea preaches in chapter after chapter against the rotten monarchy and the decadence of the rich, the awful seediness and the sleaziness of a society that has departed from the living God. But all this black velvet in Hosea is simply the background to the message of grace, which is the real point of the book. There are three wonderful words of grace shining like pearls in this 13th chapter. And before we look at them, can we just look at the black velvet that sets off the pearls? First of all, then, the first bit of the black velvet. In verse 2, a word about ingenuity. In verse 2, Hosea speaks about the ingenuity of those who are desperate in their worship of false gods. And now they sin more and more, he says, and make for themselves molten images, idols skillfully made with their silver, and all of them the work of craftsmen. You see, up to this point, idols had been chiseled out of stone, and you simply got yourself an axe or a chisel, and you worked at a lump of stone, and that was your new god. It was quite a simple thing. But now, here are men who are going through all the elaborate palaver of making molten images out of silver. And it's a word about the ingenuity of men when they turn away from the true and the living God. You see, when men are in despair about their idols that they worship, they can go to all sorts of lengths to get what they want. A little bit like Linus in the Snoopy cartoons. Linus, you remember, has a comforter. It's a disgraceful piece of old blanket. And Linus cannot live without his comforter. And when his mother takes it away to throw it into the washing machine, the poor wee lad is frantic and he's almost mentally ill until his mother brings back his blanket clean and dry and gives it to him again. He can't sleep without his comforter. And where he goes, his comforter has to go also. And in fact, this little blanket is his idol. That's the point of the story, you see. And Linus can go to all sorts of elaborate lengths to see to it that his comforter's not taken away. He buries it in the garden, and he hides it in holes, and he hides it in trees, you see. There is an ingenuity in idolatry. Here are men who used to chisel bits of stone, and now they're going through all this complicated palaver to make gods out of silver. There is an ingenuity in idol worship. I think of the extraordinary lengths to which men can go when they're hooked on alcohol, for example. Sometimes they'll go through patients' lockers in hospital, drinking eau de cologne and lavender water and drinking perfume just for the sake of a taste of alcohol. In the prisoner of war camps during the war, prisoners contrived how to make beer and wine from potato peelings rescued from the garbage cans during the war years. And I'm sure you've all heard of men who are desperate for alcohol and thrills, taking cans of Brasso and straining it through bread, and taking boot polish and processing the boot polish to make it something drinkable from which you can get a thrill. And you just need to look at today's society of idol worshippers to see the extraordinary lengths to which men will go to get what they want when they are adrift from God. There is an ingenuity in the worship of idols. Secondly, there is an absurdity in the worship of idols. At the end of the second verse, Hosea speaks about men kissing the golden bullocks. Men kiss calves. And he ridicules these grown mature men kissing the calves. And the calves here are the golden bulls that were set up by Jeroboam the First when he broke away from the house of David after the death of King Solomon. Jeroboam set up shrines, and these shrines were to be rivals to the true place of worship in Jerusalem. And he erected golden bullocks and told the men of Israel that when they said their prayers to these bullocks, they were really praying to Jehovah, because Jehovah was behind the calf. And so they started saying their prayers to the bulls, and then they offered sacrifice to the bulls. And here in Hosea, they have fallen in love with these objects, and here are grown men kissing these golden bulls. If you know Malcolm Muggeridge's essay, The Loved One, you will know the sort of prophetic scorn that Hosea has in mind here. In that essay, The Loved One is President Kennedy, and it's Muggeridge's scathing comment on Kennedy's life. It cost his father, you know, several $1 million to put his son into the White House. And Muggeridge draws a fine and a sharp picture of the way in which Kennedy was idolized and worshipped in his lifetime, with adoring crowds pushing to get near the loved one. If only they could touch his car, or if they could just touch him on the shoulder. And then came the death, the tragic death in Dallas of the loved one. And after that, of course, if you followed the story, the awful revelations of his private life, his affairs with women, and his special affair with Marilyn Monroe, and his rather sordid lifestyle with Jacqueline Kennedy. And it's that sort of denouement and deflation that men expose themselves to in the world of kissing calves. Excuse me. That's a very dangerous world to live in. Popularity, you know, is a very heady wine. You can get drunk on it very soon. And there's something absurd and tragic about grown men lavishing adoration on mortal men. The sort of love and adoration they should be reserving for Jesus Christ. Men kissing calves rather than worshipping the Lord of glory. There is an absurdity in the worship of idols. And thirdly, still part of the black velvet, in verse 3, there is an impermanence in the world of idolatry. Therefore they shall be like the morning mist, like the dew that goes away, like the chaff that swirls from the threshing floor. You know how they winnow the corn in the east. They wait for a wind, and then they go on to a high place where they'll catch the wind, and they throw the corn in the air, and the heavy grain falls down, and the husks are blown away in the wind, like the chaff that swirls from the threshing floor, or like smoke that comes from a window. The commentators point out that everything in that verse suggests impermanence and fleetingness and vanity, something that's blown away by the wind. These four images, in fact, in verse 3, all come from the country, and these are scenes from country life. Morning mist in line 1, the morning dew in line 2, the harvest chaff in line 3, and smoke coming from a window. And they all seem real enough in the early stages. After all, you can see mist, can't you? And you can walk through the grass when the dew is on it, and you can handle chaff, and you can smell wood smoke. And at first sight, they all seem real enough because they're tangible. But when you come back again after the sun is up, or after the morning wind has blown, and where are the mist and the dew and the chaff and the smoke? They've gone. They've been evaporated and blown away. And you will admit that there is that kind of instability, that kind of fleetingness and vanity, that kind of impermanence in the lives of people who turn from God to gods, who turn from the singular to the plural. I wonder, have you noticed the emptiness that's there in the lives of so many folks today? The vacuity, the nothingness at the middle of their lives, as if their lives were not built round anything, or as if they'd nothing to stand on, and nothing to hold on to, and nothing to build on. And then the sun comes, and the mist is blown away, the dew evaporates, the chaff is blown away. There's an impermanence in people who don't worship the true and the living God. And to introduce a solemn word, I see this at funerals, you know, because it's my privilege to attend many funerals. And when death comes as the ultimate embarrassment to people who do not worship the true and living God. And you can see the panic in their eyes, because they don't know where to look when death comes, and they don't know which way to turn when death comes, and there's a sort of panic and a frenzy and a despair. You see, during their lives, the mist and the dew and the chaff and the smoke were there, and it all seemed tangible. And then death comes. And the sun rises, and the wind blows, and the mist, and the dew, and the chaff, the smoke, they all disappear. And then the awful emptiness, and the vanity, and the futility of their lives are seen. There is an impermanence in the world of idols. And the fourth part of the black velvet is found in verse 6, and it's really part of an old story, the story of getting on in the world and forgetting God. Verse 6, when they had fed to the full, they were filled, and their heart was lifted up. therefore they forgot me. And that too is very true to reality. I'm sure you've all seen people getting on in the world, and the more they got on in the world, the more they forgot God. It's a strange thing, you know, that some people prosper a little and forget God, and they ascribe their prosperity to their own cleverness or their own intelligence or their own ingenuity or their own skill. They were filled and their heart was lifted up. Therefore, they forgot me. I wonder if you know the two classic passages on prosperity in the book of Deuteronomy. If you care just to turn them up, because they're words of permanent value. First of all, in verse 8, and in chapter 8, and then in verse 32, part of the Song of Moses, in Deuteronomy chapter 8, God warns them as they go into the land that they are going to prosper, but that once they prosper, they mustn't forget him. Chapter 8 and verse 12. Lest, God says, when you have eaten and are full and have built goodly houses and live in them, and when your herds and flocks multiply and your silver and gold is multiplied and all that you have is multiplied, beware that your heart be lifted up and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of a bondage. Verse 16, the God who fed you in the wilderness with manna that your fathers did not understand, that he might humble you and test you to do you good in the end. Beware lest you say in your heart, once you've got on in the world, my power and the might of my hand have gotten me this wealth. You shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth. And in chapter 32, chapter 32, if you read in from verse 10, really, God's blessing on his people as they wandered through the desert, chapter 32 and verse 10, God found Israel in a desert land and in the howling waste of the wilderness. God encircled him. God cared for him. God kept Israel as the apple of his eye, that's the pupil of his eye. Like an eagle that stirs up its nest and that flutters over its young, spreading out its wings, catching them and bearing them on its pinions. That's a verse describing an eagle, a mother eagle, teaching the babies how to fly. It gets the wee chicks into the crook at the back of its neck, and then it carries them up and drops suddenly so that the wee baby's left hanging in midair. And it's like being thrown in at the deep end of a swimming pool. If you don't swim, you'll drown. If you don't fly, you'll fall. But sometimes the baby can't fly, so the mother eagle will swoop underneath the baby and catch the baby again and take the baby back to the nest. Like an eagle that stirs up its nest and flutters over its young and then spreads out its wings, catching them, bearing them on its pinions. The Lord alone did lead Israel, and there was no strange God with him. God made Israel ride on the high places of the earth. He ate the produce of the field, here's the prosperity, and oil out of the flinty rock. Wonder what that means. Surely means olive oil. I don't think it's our kind of oil, because there's no oil in Palestine. The oil belongs to the Arabs, not the Jews. As the Jews say when they're lamenting God's apportioning of the earth, he said, the Jews in New York say, why did God give the Arabs all the land where the oil is? and oil from the flinty rock, but I think it's olive oil. Prosperity again in 4:14, curds from the herd and milk from the flock, with fat of lambs and rams, herds of Bashan and goats, with the finest of the wheat and of the blood of the grape, you drank wine. But Chishurun waxed fat and kicked. Chishurun's a nickname for Israel. It means the righteous one. It's a Hebrew word for righteous one. This is what happened to him when he got on in the world. Chishurun waxed fat and kicked. You waxed fat. You grew thick. You became sleek. And then he forsook God who made him and scoffed at the rock of his salvation. And it's that sort of thing that you find here in Hosea chapter 13 and verse 6. The dangers of prosperity. When they had fed to the full, they were filled and their heart was lifted up, and therefore they forgot me. And all of that is the black velvet of this chapter. But all of that is not the main point of the chapter. The point is not the velvet, but the three pearls that lie in front of it. And the first pearl is found in the first verse. When Ephraim spoke, men trembled, and he was exalted in Israel. And that verse is the picture of a church which can speak with authority to men. And when such a church speaks to men, men sit up and listen and fear. One thinks of the Apostle Paul preaching before Felix, the Roman governor, in Acts chapter 25. And we read there, as Paul reasoned with him, this proud Roman governor sitting on his throne, as Paul reasoned with him about justice and self-control and the coming judgment, Felix trembled. A Christian voice before which men tremble. And it's that kind of thing that you find in this verse. Ephraim speaks and men tremble. And apparently the reference is to Judges chapter 8 and verse 1, where Gideon has gone out to battle against the Midianites, and he forgot to give an invitation to the tribe of Ephraim. And the tribe of Ephraim was a bit huffed because they hadn't been asked to take part in the battle, because they were the biggest tribe and they had very fine fighting men. And so they collar Gideon, the ruler of the nation, the judge of Israel, by the ears. And they give him a sound telling off at the start of Judges chapter 8. And Ephraim spoke, and Gideon trembled, and the whole army trembled with him when Ephraim spoke. I think back a century ago when men like Bishop Ryle of Durham could preach, and men listened because they knew that Bishop Ryle had something to say to the nation. That's why the Victorians were such avid readers of sermons, printed sermons. Nowadays, you know, people don't read sermons, and books of sermons are very rare on the book market. It's a brave minister who would try to publish his sermons nowadays, because published sermons are just non-starters. People don't read sermons nowadays, but the Victorians loved them. They devoured sermons, and they devoured tracts as well. The Victorian age, you know, was the age of the Christian tract. I have a book of them at home. I picked it up in a second-hand market, and there are tracts on every conceivable subject under the sun. and on some conceivable subjects not under the sun as well. Sunday railways, the dangers of travelling by rail on the Lord's Day. What sort of tract would they write today? The sanctity of the Sabbath, the dangers of strong drink. Lots of tracts on strong drink. One of the curses of the Victorian age, the great gin parlours. The need for servants to honour their masters. Tracts on eternal damnation. And the Victorians devoured all this because Ephraim was speaking and men were trembling. Or if you go back before the Victorians to the days of John Owen, who could preach to Parliament, Cromwell's Parliament, on the need for men to be reconciled to God through the blood of Jesus Christ. Imagine the chaplain of the House of Commons preaching a sermon today on the need for men to be reconciled to God through the blood of Christ. John Owen even once delivered a famous sermon entitled, What It Means to Be Without Christ, and he preached it to the House of Commons. And the House of Commons trembled. Ephraim spoke, and men were afraid. Or go back a century before John Owen to John Donne, the Dean of St. Paul's Cathedral, not the St. Paul's Cathedral we know today, but the great Gothic cathedral that used to stand there and which was destroyed in the Great Fire of London. That's where John Donne used to preach. He used to preach in the open air, in the graveyard, with people sitting on the tombs listening to him. And he used to preach to the court and to the royal family. And if you've read any of his sermons, you can see that John Donne didn't spare the royal family the truth. He didn't pander just because royal blood was there. He preached to the royal family great sermons on death and eternity and on the judgment of God. And men were riveted. Charles I was riveted. They were arrested because Ephraim was speaking. And men were trembling. Now, the church has lost that kind of authority today. And it's a kind of authority that the church needs to recover, and the church can recover. I think of how, you know, in our own General Assembly, until about 20, 25 years ago, the most important night during the General Assembly, there were two nights actually, one of them was the Church and Nation night, and the other was the Overseas Council night. And the Assembly Hall used to be absolutely packed on those two evenings. The Church and Nation night, because here was the church speaking on the social and the moral issues of the day. And the overseas night, because here was the church speaking about missionary outreach and the spreading of the name of Christ amongst the heathen nations. And if you can cast your mind back 20 years to the assemblies of those days, they were always packed to the door, and the public galleries were absolutely groaning with people. You couldn't get in. You needed a ticket to get in, to hear what the church had to say. And the voice was heeded, because when Ephraim spoke, men were trembling. But that has pretty largely gone. You know that Church and Nation night and the Overseas Council night are just about the dullest evenings in the General Assembly. Not many people turn out to hear. The galleries were filled with empty seats last year. And you just need to look down at the press seats, where all the pressmen and the reporters sit, just to see how absolutely bored and uninterested these newsmen are. Because to them, you see, this is not news. What the church has to say is not news. Ephraim speaks, and men don't tremble anymore. In fact, men don't even listen anymore. But that could change. And it will change when Christians give a clear and a decisive testimony. It's when the church stands back from the politics and the social involvement of its time that it can then bring God's word of grace and of judgment to the situation. It's because the mini politicians and the mini psychiatrists in 121 George Street have become involved with their petty politics that men don't listen anymore. Men will not listen to mini politicians in the churches and mini psychiatrists. But when the Church of Christ becomes detached from these great issues, and when Christians separate themselves in consecration, the church can again exert a prophetic ministry and bring a word from God to the needy and the benighted souls of men. The day may yet come when Ephraim speaks, and when he does, men will tremble. May God hasten the coming of that day. The second peril is found in verse 4. I am the Lord your God from the land of Egypt. You know no God but me, and besides me there is no Savior. Look at that third line. You know no God but me. Now, of course, the knowledge of God is the main message of the book of Hosea, and there are all sorts of references to it. If you look back to chapter 2 and verse 20, his wife, Hosea's wife, has just gone off and left him, and he has chased her into the wilderness, and he's going to bring her back again to her own husband and her home. And in chapter 2 and verse 20, he says, I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord. Israel was to know the Lord in the way in which a wife was to know her husband. Not knowing about her husband, because of course knowing about somebody is not the same as knowing the person. I know about Shakespeare. A little bit. I know about Julius Caesar. I know about Charles Haddon Spurgeon. But so far I have not yet met these people. And until you meet somebody, how can you know him? If you want to know God, you've got to know him and meet him. God, Hosea is going to bring her back again. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord. It's referred to again in chapter 4 and the second half of the first verse, where God says, this is what's wrong with your country. There's no faithfulness or kindness, and there is no knowledge of God in the land. People may know about him, but they don't know him. Verse 6. This is what's wrong with your society, God says. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected knowledge, the knowledge of God, I reject you from being a priest to me. And lastly, in chapter 3 and verse, chapter 6 and verse 3, where people decide to come back to God, they say, let us know, let us press on to know the Lord. His going forth is as sure as the dawn. Verse 6, God says, what I desire is steadfast love and not sacrifice, and the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. Now, of course, all of that was rooted in Hosea's home life and in his marriage to this fickle woman. who had lived with him all these years, but had never known her husband in a deep and real way. She knew all about her husband, the sort of food he liked, the sort of clothes he wore, his habits, but she did not know him. And it's that kind of knowledge that Hosea has in mind in chapter 13 and verse 4 and the third line, where God says, "You know no God but me." Now, I think that's an important line. You know no God but me. In fact, you can know God because it's not possible to know idols. You can't know false gods in the way that you can know God. If you make a god of your house, you can't know your house. If you make a god of your bank account and your shares, you can't know a bank account. If you make a god of your dog or your cat or your budgie or whatever, you can't know a dog and a cat and a budgie. If you make a god of success, you cannot know success. You cannot know them because, in fact, they're dead. The prophetic insistence is that idols are dumb idols. If there were time, we could look into verses in Isaiah and Jeremiah. Clock has stopped, George. Must be careful. Verses in Isaiah and Jeremiah where they look at the idols of the day and they say, "Well, there's a braw bunch for you. They've got ears, because you could see their ears. But they can't hear you. They've got noses, but they can't smell you. They've got hands and feet, but they can't move. They've got to be carried about because they're lifeless." All the gods, says the psalmist, are idols dumb, which blinded nations fear. But our God is the Lord by whom the heavens created were. You cannot know dumb idols. They're useless. They're dead. They can't hear your prayers. You can't say your prayers to a house or a bank account or a dog or a cat or a budgie or success. You cannot know them because they're dead. But you can know God because he hears and answers and feels and knows and lives. You know no God but me, and besides me there is no Savior. And the third great pearl, and the last one, is in the 13th verse. The pangs of childbirth come for him, but he's an unwise son, for now he does not present himself for birth at the mouth of the womb. And the picture here is rather an intimate picture of a child on the threshold of being born. But something goes wrong and the child is stuck and refuses to come into the world. And in that world, that kind of child was called an unwise son. All the promise and the hope were there. And he was almost into life. He was almost out of the old world and into the new world. And he stopped on the threshold. Now, the time has gone, but there are many references to that kind of picture in Isaiah chapter 37 and 3. You find it in Galatians chapter 4 and 19. You find it, a child on the threshold of being born, and yet unwilling to leave the old world and come out into the new. And the message in this 13th verse is that there is a ripeness in God's timing. There's a time to be born, by which I mean there is a time to be born into Christ and into salvation and into grace. There is a time for a Christian to be born into his life's work, into his spiritual destiny, into his service for Christ. This is what the Greeks used to call kairos time, K-A-I-R-O-S. You know that the Greeks had two words for time. The one was chronos time, which is time on the clock, ticking away. Rather not ticking away. Eating up your years. Right now you'll be older by the time you leave the service, because chronos will have gobbled up an hour of your life. But there's another kind of time in Greek. It's called kairos time. And kairos time is always now. When Jesus preached his first sermon and said, "The time is at hand," that's the word he used, kairos. God's time is always now. The time to be saved is now. The time to consecrate yourself to Christ is now. The time of destiny is right now. And that's the message here. This child on the verge of a new life. There comes God's time in your life. If you are not a Christian, and of course it may well be that you're in church for all sorts of reasons, there is a time to come to Christ. There is a time to be saved. There is a time to be converted. You cannot come to Christ when you like. You cannot be saved when you want to be saved. You cannot be converted at your time. You can be converted only at God's time. For Felix, in the book of Acts, the Roman governor, his time, his ripe time, was when Paul preached to him and Felix trembled, and he decided that that's not the sort of thing he wanted, and so he wasn't saved. For a blind Bartimaeus, God's ripe time was when Jesus passed through Jericho, because Jesus went through Jericho only once. He never went back again. For blind Bartimaeus, that was the time. For Jerusalem, the ripeness of the time was when Jesus wept over the city and said, "O Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them that are sent to thee, how often would I have gathered thee as a hen gathers her chickens, but ye would not, for you did not know the hour of your visitation." It's God's time. It was ripe. The baby was on the verge of being born. It was the hour of salvation and of destiny. Can I just give a word of testimony in closing as to how God's time has operated in my own life. Back in the early years, my childhood was spent under the preaching of John MacLeod from Lewis, from Knock in Lewis. Rather stern preaching and over preoccupied with prophecy and the book of Daniel forever and ever. But he was a very faithful old man in his own way. He was an old-fashioned preacher. I suppose I must have heard the gospel often from him, and I just vaguely recall the voice of Jesus and a bell ringing. Bell ringing. So I silenced the bell. And I recall a chap who used to sing, not a chap, a man who used to sing in the choir called Scrimmager. Mrs. Nicol here, who played the organ in those days, will recall Mr. Scrimmager. He was the local lawyer and a very stentorian bass. You needed only one bass when he was singing in the choir. And he once collared me in the main street and said, "You know, Tommy, I think you should be a minister." I wasn't converted. But a bell rang. I switched it off. And then, in my first year at university, one of my pals was courting a servant girl in a nunnery in Aberdeen. And we asked this girl to smuggle us into the nunnery, because I wanted to see the nuns saying their prayers. So we got smuggled into the nunnery, and we hid in the darkness behind the rood screen. R-O-O-D. And we watched the nuns in this lovely chapel, scarlet and gold, very lovely, the candles and all that. And a line from a hymn they were singing hit me. "Counting all loss, if only I find Jesus." The bell rang, that awful bell, that awful bell. I switched it off. And then came the teaching post in Gardenstown, James Phillips preaching, Billy Graham's first visit to this country, Tell Scotland Crusade. And in each of those times when the bell rang, there was I at the mouth of the womb, and I was on the verge of being born into a new world, into a world of life and grace and Jesus. Got stuck, held back, like Ephraim. The pangs of childbirth come for him, but he's an unwise son, and now he doesn't present himself properly at the mouth of the womb. I wonder if there's anyone here tonight